Greetings and welcome to the Navigator newsletter for the month May 2016. Or if you follow the Kemetic calendar, the year is 6250. This podcast is narrated and produced by Paul Ifeomi Grant.
Right, welcome to part two of the newsletter. I'd finished part one by saying I was going to tell you a little bit about the people who were the brains behind the EEC. And in the BBC timeline, I mentioned it starts off in 1948 and it's headlined Plans for a Peaceful Europe. And it says, in the wake of World War II, nationalism is out of favour in large parts of continental Europe and support for federalism is high. The European Union of Federalists organises a Congress at The Hague in 1948 in the hope of drawing up a European constitution. But the UK rejects the federal approach and the result is a Council of Europe, a loose grouping that becomes a guardian of Europe's human rights. So that was kind of at the beginning. Britain did eventually join the European Union. The former Prime Minister of Britain, Edward Heath, was happy to agree to join the European Union, recognising that it would mean some diminution of sovereignty. And Britain joined in 1973. And of course, to be reasonable, if you join a political club, you are going to probably have some loss of sovereignty. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the so-called alternative media who try to substantiate the opposition to structures such as the EU on sort of dubious conspiratorial quotes, such as the following, which is attributed to Jean Monnet, who was the first Deputy Secretary General of the Interwar League of Nations, but who is now often cited as a key European superstate bogeyman. Now, Monnet is alleged to have said, this is the quote that he's alleged to have said, Europe's nations should be guided towards the superstate without their people understanding what is happening. This can be accomplished by successive steps, each disguised as having an economic purpose, which will irreversibly lead to federation. However, unfortunately, there is no strong evidence that Monnet ever made this statement, and its use simply discredits the many very sensible arguments against EU membership. Now, there is a quote which can be confidently attributed to Monnet, and that was made in 1943, in which he set out his statement of beliefs. And in this quote, he said, there will be no peace in Europe if the states are reconstituted on the basis of national sovereignty. The countries of Europe are too small to guarantee their people the necessary prosperity and social development. The European states must constitute themselves into a federation. Now, this is a very different proposition, which could be conceived as more akin to the present EU, particularly the Eurozone, than a superstate. However, on the other hand, you need to remember that the United States is a federation of states under a federal government. And so the same word can have different meanings to different people. So for one person, it can mean a loose federation. For others, it can mean one state with federal components. So let's look at the main argument, which is often pushed by pro-EU advocates, and that's the economic case for membership of the European Union. Now, one of the things that really perplexes me when they talk about the arguments for the EU is the idea that if Britain left the EU, suddenly all, or at least a significant percentage of the jobs which are dependent upon trade with EU nations would just disappear. This is the argument said that there's, 5 million jobs or whatever the figure is in Britain that are dependent on trade with EU nations. And the implication is that if Britain left the EU, these jobs would just all disappear. Now, it's such a ridiculous idea that it's absolutely remarkable how often it is repeated without serious questioning. Because if you ask yourself, if Britain left the EU, would the French stop buying Scotch whisky? And would the British stop buying French wine? Now, the answer is, of course not. Most consumer buying decisions are based on price and quality, not the nationality or ownership of production. People buy Mercedes cars around the world, not because they're produced by a so-called German corporation, but because Mercedes makes high-quality cars. People don't care if Germany's in the EU or whether it's out of the EU when it comes to buying a Mercedes car. The only reason that Britain would suffer in terms of trade with EU nations if it exited the EU would be if some form of punishment mechanism such as trade tariffs were enacted by those member EU nations. And you have to remember, this is not the basis of the economic argument being used by the Yes campaign. They're not saying if Britain left the EU, there'll be trade sanctions and punishments. What they're suggesting is that there's something inherently beneficial to Britain's economy from being in the EU. Now, what that is, they don't specify, other than suggesting that somehow these jobs would disappear. And again, they can't tell us why jobs would disappear just by not being in the EU. It's also worth remembering, which I noted in a previous newsletter, that recently the United States overtook France to become Germany's largest trading partner. And that was for the first time since the 1960s, which again demonstrates how baseless the economic argument is, because the United States, of course, is not in the European Union. And one of the main reasons for this change is because the euro has fallen in relative value to the dollar, which makes German exports a lot cheaper to the United States than they have been in the past, whereas, of course, France and Germany use the same currency, the euro, so there'll be no fall in the price of German exports to France. The Yes campaign, they also can't explain why the people of nations such as Switzerland are not all living in poverty, sitting outside of the European Union as they do. So why don't countries outside of the European Union in Western Europe, why aren't they all poor and impoverished, lacking jobs? And we have not even spoken about the economic rape of Greece. I mean, the people of Greece are, how can I describe them? They're like serfs voting for serfdom in their desperate desire to stay in the EU. So they're completely contradictory. They say they want to be taken out of this economic penury that's been imposed upon them, this punishment that's been imposed upon them, which is really as a result of connivance and corruption between former Greek politicians, Goldman Sachs, and the European Union and various banks, when they both fixed the books to make it appear that Greece complied with the criteria for being able to join the EU, when they knew that Greece didn't comply, so they committed a form of fraud. And then there was all the loans which these politicians took out with backhanders, no doubt, which has put Greece in this terrible position. And if you look at the European Union and you look at Greece and then you look at the ex-Goldman Sachs executive Mario Draghi, who's now the head of the European Central Bank and who's been going like gangbangers in terms of money printing, a most incredible splurge of money printing you can think about. And then you think about the stupidity of one currency and one interest rate for European Eurozone countries. So Greece is supposed to have the same interest rate policy as Germany, which makes absolutely no sense. They've got vastly different economies and they need different interest rates at different times. So the economic case is a complete red herring, because the EU has always been about politics. It was founded as a political vehicle because of the aftermath of the Second European World War. They wanted to particularly unite France and Germany. They wanted to stop the idea, prevent another war conflagration in Europe. It was about politics. And now they've grafted on these ideas of massive economic benefits and disbenefits if you leave. So the political and cultural argument for the EU actually makes more sense than the economic argument, particularly if you're a supporter of Western imperialism, often known as white supremacy. I don't know how many of you listening are, but if you are, then there's actually some merits to the argument of Britain staying in the EU, because the EU provides a ready-made forum in which the leaders of Europe can debate and discuss how they will follow and support the US in maintaining so-called Western political and economic hegemony. If you go back in time, absolute monarchs around the world and throughout the ages have often justified their rulership with ideas of their so-called divine right to rule, which basically means that they were chosen by their nation's god or deity to rule because they come from a special bloodline, which obviously is the base of monarchy. Now, Europeans have used a broader civilizational version of this argument to justify their right to rule the earth and also to plunder its resources while they're at it. Ideas such as Britain's civilizing mission during Britain's empire, the white man's burden, manifest destiny, American exceptionalism, the Monroe Doctrine, the Wolf of Its Doctrine, and all the others all come from the same ideological playbook. They're underpinned by the notion of a rigid racial hierarchy, but they're rephrased for the contemporary age in more sort of euphemistic terms. So the EU works with the US government, and they serve the interests of transnational corporations and the super rich, and they're supported by the corporate media, foundations, think tanks, etc., in a complex web of overlapping interests, which as a minimum seeks to maintain the economic and political status quo, but with the end goal of creating such a concentration of wealth and power that there becomes no possibility of meaningful change. Now, Amos Wilson depicted this network of power diagrammatically in his seminal work, Blueprint for Black Power, which I say is still a must read. Or if you like, you can listen to large excerpts from the book on YouTube, where Amos Wilson actually, you can hear him speaking before he'd actually published a book, but talking about the content of the book. And things have only got a lot worse since he produced that book. So yes, there is a strong argument that can be made for the EU from a European power perspective. Okay, so having said all that, why is it the case that it probably won't matter even if Britain leaves the EU? So I'm going to vote for Britain to leave the EU, but I'm saying it probably won't matter. Well, in the last issue of the newsletter, I mentioned the dangers of the TPP and TTIP, those trade agreements, as part of the globalization agenda, and more specifically how they would give corporations' economic interests precedent over a nation's national sovereignty. And I'd put up a link to an explanatory video by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts in the last issue. So if you go back to the last issue, you can go back and check out that link. And it's about half an hour, I think, and listen to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts explaining what the implications are of these types of agreements. Now, the real point in relation to the European Union is that if the UK signs up to TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or any other similar agreement, it won't matter if Britain leaves the EU or not, as we'll effectively have given up its national sovereignty in a way that's much more fundamental than anything imposed by the EU. So yes, the EU takes some powers, but what TTIP will do will be so fundamental, it won't matter whether Britain's in or out. So I'm going to vote no to the EU, but with a realistic understanding of what this means, given that the leading figures in the No campaign are not talking about TTIP. My expectation, though, is that the Yes campaign will win, due to the fear campaign they will run, much in the same way the Scottish population lost their nerve in the face of a governmental, corporate and media onslaught during their UK referendum about whether Scotland should stay part of the United Kingdom or not. And again, even the people who wanted to leave the UK had it completely wrong, because they wanted to stay in the European Union. And if they leave the UK and stay in the European Union, you just basically going out of your jail cell and finding that you stayed in a much larger prison. So I think the Yes campaign will win, because it seems that many people are frightened of what they think is the unknown, and it seems that fear is more powerful than hope, which is a bit of a sad reflection. So I'm going to finish off now with just some reflections regarding the African Union, because I know many people in the quote-unquote conscious community are great advocates of the African Union, but I've always been pretty sceptical about its benefits. And you do probably know I'm not a great believer in its efficacy as a tool for the liberation of African people on the continent or anywhere else for that matter. I mean, in previous newsletters and probably in some of my books and lectures, I've explained why I don't believe in the continentalist version of Pan-Africanism, you know, the version promoted by Kwame Nkrumah. That's the version which places more emphasis on uniting the people who live on the African continent irrespective of whether they're African or not, rather than uniting African people, irrespective of whether they live in Africa or not. Because the original version of Pan-Africanism that was formed at the various conferences, Sylvester Williams, a Trinidadian lawyer, Marcus Garvey came later on, all those people in the sort of late 19th century, early 20th century, who advocated Pan-Africanism, they were talking about, as Marcus Garvey described it, uniting the 400 million Negroes of the world. So uniting African people, black people around the world, irrespective of where they lived. The continentalist version is preoccupied with the landmass of Africa, and that's the priority. Now, given that 40% of Africa has already been taken over by Arabs and people of various ethnicities in the north, your focus can't just be on the landmass, it's got to be on African people. It's crazy, because if we still had an apartheid type regime in South Africa, or if Europeans had completely colonized South Africa, would we still say they should be part of Pan-Africanism? So the focus should be on African people, wherever we are, not just on the landmass. Because the land without the people, what does that mean then? So, just to briefly add to that and reprise my concerns, the African Union is part funded by European powers. Do you really think they're funding it for our liberation? Also, as I've said previously, you cannot create a strong chain out of weak links. So attempting to create one gigantic superstate out of a multitude of basket case countries makes absolutely no sense. And of course, Africa has never ever been one country in its history. And yet it's been the home of many great civilizations. So why does it have to be a single country now in order for African people to be empowered? Doesn't make any sense. Look at the power of the United States. It's much smaller than Africa. Look at the power of China. Tiny in comparison to the whole of the African landmass. You can fit China into Africa many times over. Again, as I've mentioned in previous newsletters, the European Union is a more logical federation than the African Union, since it brings together nations with the same civilization identity, in stark contrast to the African Union. So don't hold your breath and think that African Union is going to liberate African people anytime soon. It won't. So in conclusion, if you live in the UK and you're going to vote in the EU referendum, do your own research, make up your own mind. But irrespective of the outcome of the vote, understand that the plutocrats are not going to let up their attempts to tighten their grip on the world's people and resources. But still, it could be a battle worth winning. So until next time, remember, it's time to win. And remember to go and check out the site, blackfinancialfitness.com. Fill in the survey if you can. And get ready for the launch in June. Take care.